Here on Radio 4 FM, the acclaimed actor Alan Cumming continues to read from his powerful memoir, which tells the story of his relationship with his violent father. In today's episode of Not My Father's Son, Alan is preparing to take part in the television series Who Do You Think You Are? He's looking forward to clearing up the mystery around his grandfather's death in Malaysia. But he's been knocked sideways by a piece of news his brother brings him from his estranged father.
Before I had really processed what Tom had said, I found myself propelling backwards, knocking over the bench I was sitting on and careening away from my brother. "What do you mean I'm not his son?" I kept asking. Tom was holding me now, trying to calm me down. "You're not his son," Tom said again. He said he was never going to tell you and was just going to leave you a letter in his will. But he knew you were doing the television show, and so he wanted to tell you to stop you being embarrassed in public by finding out that way. Tom was rubbing tears away with his thumb. Here we were once again, weeping and scared and clinging to each other. I thought our father had no power over us anymore. I was wrong. "He says if you ask Mum, she'll deny it, but he's willing to take a DNA test. He says that he and Mum were at a hotel dance. Mum was gone for a while, and this guy's wife said he was gone too. And Dad and the wife both started looking for them. They saw them, Mum and the guy, coming out of a bedroom together."
"And then what?"
"And then, 9 months later, you were born."
"What about Mum?"
I asked. "Did you talk to her about it?" "Not yet," said Tom. Although I was shell-shocked by the news, I was also so glad my mother had had someone else in her life. Some love. Someone who hopefully treated her with kindness and tenderness. If I was the product of that, it couldn't be such a bad thing, I decided. "And there's another thing," Tom said. "Dad's thinking of talking to the papers. He's angry that they know about him having cancer, and they're telling him he should have his say about you before he dies." I couldn't believe it. Any of it. Tom stayed over that night. We were spent, dazed, cried, and talked out. We said goodnight, and I switched the light off. But after a while, I could feel him still awake across from me. "You know, Alan, you're lucky. You're lucky you're not his son." "I know," I said. It was incredible to think of my mother being the one who had strayed, when it was my father's infidelity that had so upset me as a child. My father was a big philanderer. Everyone knew. Even when I was at primary school, I was aware that he was having affairs. Now it was all beginning to make sense. Was his brazen disregard for my mother's and anyone else's feelings about his affairs due to the fact that he felt justified because my mother had committed the original sin? It certainly explained the way he treated me. Hundreds of flashbacks of acts of violence and humiliation were being replayed in my mind. I see a freezing, wintry afternoon in the sawmill yard. I am on the red bike I was given for Christmas, and my father has decided that today is the day that I must ride it without stabilizers. There is ice and snow on the ground, and I see my father taking the stabilizers off and pushing me down the driveway too fast. Every time he does so, I panic and fall off. And soon he gets frustrated with my failure and pulls my trousers down and slaps me really hard on my bare bum. I don't remember how it ended. What I do remember is my mum washing me and getting me ready for bed in front of the living room fire later that night, and her gasping as she saw the ring of blue, black and purple bruises that had appeared. My father came in to say goodbye before he went out for the night, and my mother admonished him for his handiwork. "He's all right," he said, running a comb through his hair as he looked in the mirror. Sunday, 23rd of May, 2010. Grant woke me up on Sunday morning. He had arrived home in New York, listened to the messages I'd left him, and got straight back on a plane. I was more and more worried about the possibility of my father giving an interview to the papers. Was he going to spill the beans to the press before he'd even spoken to me? Or before I had a chance to talk to my mum? But that just didn't make sense. My father would never allow the last thing the world knew of him before he died to be that he had been cuckolded. Tom had spoken to him again a couple of times in the past few days and informed him that I wanted to go ahead with the DNA test. He told me our father had begun to prevaricate and wanted to wait a few days before going ahead with any test. I decided I needed to speak to the man myself. I asked Tom for my father's phone number and called. It went straight to voicemail. The machine beeped. "Hello, this is Alan. Cumming. I'm calling to speak to Alec. Cumming. I really need to talk to him about some things that I think he'll know about, and I would really appreciate it if he would call me back as soon as possible." I thought I was about to hang up, but found myself saying more. "It's urgent. It's really urgent, so please do call me as soon as you can. Thank you." As the minutes turned into hours, the fact that he was purposely not calling me back made me more and more angry. I called again at 7 p.m. No answer. I felt like I was a child again, waiting for him to come and inspect me. But this time I was more angry and frustrated than anxious. Grant had told me that I didn't need him to do a DNA test, as men hand down identical Y chromosomes to all their male offspring. Tom and I could do a test, and if the Y chromosomes didn't match, that would be proof enough that my father's story was true. So we found the kits on the internet and ordered them. Once more, I went to sleep, as I had done so many times as a little boy, with the full knowledge that I could never rely on my father. I was 45 years old. I'd been waiting for a phone call from him since I was 29, my age the last time we spoke. I guess I should have known what to expect. In the morning, I woke early and got ready. Despite everything that had happened, I was actually excited about appearing on Who Do You Think You Are? There was nothing more I could do about the issue of my father at that moment. I decided to focus on diving into the TV show and to solving the mystery of my maternal grandfather, Tommy Darling. As I rang for the lift to take me down to the streets of Soho, my phone rang. "Hello there, this is Alec Cumming." At first I didn't recognise his voice. There was kindness in it. And of course he didn't say, "It's your dad," so I was thrown all the more. I had started my day determined to take control of my feelings and my situation. Now I panicked. "I can't speak to you now," came from somewhere inside me. "I have to go to work." I suddenly remembered reading in one of the hundreds of emails sent to me with the details of my week that I would be done by 5 p.m. this afternoon. "I'll call you back at 5 o'clock. I couldn't believe how calm and forceful I was being. I hung up. My legs buckled from under me. Aside from "hello" and "take care" at my granny's funeral, those were the first words I had spoken to my father in over 16 years. I spent the next few hours being filmed wandering around Covent Garden watching the street entertainers for the beginning of my episode of Who Do You Think You Are? It was a sunny day, and I looked like I didn't have a care in the world. "Nobody knows," I thought. "Nobody knows." We went to an apartment nearby to do an establishing interview about my reasons for doing the show and what I hoped to find out. I realised that I don't really know much about my family beyond the ones that are alive, I began. Every word I spoke seemed to me dripping with irony, and it got worse. "You base who you are on your immediate lineage, and so If there are gaps in that, and mysteries in that, there are mysteries in you. I had thought we were staying that evening in London, but was told that we were leaving immediately for the train station. At 5 p.m. that afternoon, I wasn't sitting comfortably in the privacy of my own flat, dialing my father's number, but on a train, zooming north towards Scotland. I cleared my throat, laid out my pad and pen. This wasn't going to be easy. I waited till 5 o'clock and pressed call. He answered after a few rings. Hello? His voice. Fainter than I remembered, but with the same Highland upward inflection as always. Hi, it's Alan. Uh-huh. Are you doing? Well, obviously, I'm not doing so great. Don't get riled. I've a lot of questions I'd like to ask you, and so I'd just like to get started. I looked down at my notes. I'd made a list with careful spaces for me to scribble down his answers. I needed to remember every second of this conversation. Are you certain? Are you absolutely certain? I tried to sound flat and scientific. I'd never have brought it up if I wasn't certain, Alan. Again, we went over the story of the dance at the hotel. And you never talked about it again with my mother? Ever? I asked. Well, once, years later, it nearly came up. My father paused, and then, it was on your birthday, funnily enough. I sat, stunned into silence. You must have known, Alan. What? For a moment, everything stopped. Come on, you must have known. He was almost jovial, like we had jumped to the we can laugh about it now stage of this story. How could I possibly have known? My father cleared his throat and paused for effect. Did you not notice we never bonded? He said. Now everything sped up. A series of nanosecond memories from years ago bombarded my vision. My father's furious and demented face, the stinging his hands left on me, the humiliation, the despair. I wanted to scream out that yes, I had indeed wondered why we never bonded, but him not being my biological father was not the reason why. But I couldn't. I was quite literally stunned. And then I got it. He was asking me to accept that his behaviour to me was justified because I was not his blood. He wanted me to condone my own physical and mental abuse. I told my father I was going ahead with the DNA test. I'm not sending a swab to America, came the retort. He was angry now. Well, you don't need to. I explained how Tom and I would take the test ourselves. I would be in touch when I had the results. I could tell the wind had been blown out of his sails. Withholding his DNA was his last trump card. Now he was the one who would have to wait. I put the phone down next to my pad and pen, then clasped my hands together and allowed my body to shake. Sunny England sped by. I pulled myself together and walked back the few carriages to join the BBC crew.
Alan Cumming continues to read from his memoir, Not My Father's Son, at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Sarah Davis, and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. For details of organisations which offer advice and support about the issues raised, go online to bbc.co.uk/actionline. Or call the Radio 4 Action Line to hear recorded information on 0800 044 044. Lines are open 24 hours and are free from most landlines. Some networks and mobile operators will charge for these calls. One of the most iconic voices in British music discusses her more than 60 years in the music industry, Dame Shirley Bassey, on Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes.